Well, my name is Arthur Bostrom, and I played Officer Crabtree in Hello, Hello. And I got the part directly because I'd been about 3 years before I got Hello, Hello, which was 1985, I got Hello, Hello. I'd been in an episode of Heidi High, and I did a small part in that, only four lines, a little scene with Sue Pollard. And I was playing a not very bright boyfriend she'd had for a week. And she was saying goodbye to me on the bus. You know, I was really sort of monosyllabic, only said a couple of words and all that. But it was a funny scene. I mean, Sue's hilarious anyway. And David Croft, really, who was directing, and of course had co-written it, really liked it and gave me more to do. I mean, on the waving goodbye on the bus, he got me to open one of the windows, those sort of narrow windows, and stick my head out sideways and wave. And I was kind of going, bye, Peggy, you know, in a really stupid way, which got big laughs, you know. So that was the start. So he gave me more than the actual scene. This is a long story, but I'll tell you anyway. But the lovely Jeff Holland, who played Spike in Heidi High, he was watching and everything, and he came over afterwards and he said, I always remember what he said, and he said to me, oh, the boss really likes it, meaning David Croft, because he used to sit there watching on a monitor screen as it was filmed on, like, this was on location in the holiday camp, and he always used to, his shoulders used to go up and down with laughter. That's something I always remember about David Croft. And he was laughing away at the scene. So he said, so Jeff said, you know, the boss really likes it. So he said, I really hope it happens for you. You know, I mean, he said, all of us here pretty well in this series, IDI, I hear because we worked with David before. He asked us to do, I mean, Jeff had done the Dad's Army stage show. And other people have been in other series, you know, been in Dad's Army and other series and things like that. So he said, he said, keep in touch with him. He said, but I really hope it happens for you. Well, I mean, I did keep in touch, and I went to see the episode being recorded in the studio, you know, in the sets and everything. And I even went to the end of series party. And it was because, you know, the then runner, but also became director of David Croft series later on, Robin Carr, kept telling me, keep turning up and show your face. You know, and I did it on the night that we filmed as well. I mean, we were staying, those of us that were guest actors in that program, that episode of Heidi High, were in one hotel, and the main cast of Hello, Hello were in a rather, of Heidi High were in a rather better hotel up the way. And Sue Pollard said, are you going to come to the, you know, you're going to come up to our hotel for a drink and a meal, you know, and all that stuff. She was in the view. I said, yeah, I will. No one else wanted to go, so I went on my own, which was kind of pretty brave, because I'm not usually that brave at, you know, pushing myself forward. And I stood there in the bar nursing a pint, and eventually people from the car started to come down, and they were the other side of this big bar and all that, and noticed I was there, but nobody said anything. And then David Croft came down. And then, you know, after about 5 minutes, he said, you know, do come and join us, Arthur. Do come over, you know, and join us. So I did. And I spent the evening and, you know, had a meal with them and sat next to Sue. And, you know, the whole thing was hilarious. But, you know, I mean, knowing what I know now, that really did count for a lot with David Croft, because he liked people. Well, you've got to be good at what you do, obviously. He was watching people like that, and he used to try people out in a small part. And if he liked how you were, and also very importantly, he used to watch to see how people got on with other people, because you're making a team, you know, of people for that. And so he must have noticed that I was interested in that and keen and all of that. So anyway, that was that. 3 years later, I'd seen the first series of Hello, Hello. I mean, I'd actually written in and said, oh, if there's anything, you know, please keep me in mind. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant from the pilot episode, which I'd seen. And then, you know, when the first series kind of thought, well, this is fantastic. So anyway, nothing happened in the first series. And then I'd just been offered a week in Madrid, Spain, doing an IBM conference, of all things, because they used to use actors a lot. I think they still do, you know, conferences and stuff like that. And it was a lot of money because IBM was, you know, and I was just a struggling jobbing actor, you know, and mostly working in bars and things like that. So it was a lot of money, and I was waiting for the money to be sorted out. When I got rung up at home, they didn't, it was David Croft's secretary, just to inquire whether I was available for the next, in 3 weeks' time, for 10 weeks. And I said, well, I'm awfully sorry, I'm not, because I've got this job, and you know. So not to worry. That time, I'm sure there'd be something else, and put the phone down. And then I thought, and I rang my agent, who said, oh my goodness, you know, he said, well, you know, let me have a think about this and we'll get back to you. This was on a Friday lunchtime, right? And in March in 1985, this is when I did. And I was, yeah, about 5 minutes later, they rang back and said, we've got to get you in. You've got to go and see them. You know, and it was that afternoon they wanted to see me. They said, if you get the job, we'll get you out of that other job. So I went, okay then. So, you know, barely 3 hours later, I'm at the BBC Television Centre. And there were a few other people there. You know, I saw people, you know, waiting to go in. I think you saw about a dozen people. And I was given a couple of pages of script. And the script for Crabtree was written phonetically. So it was, you know, the wobbly fret, so that you knew how to do it. I mean, I can make it up now, but then, and as soon as I saw that script, I thought, I've never felt like this in my life so much. I thought, I have to have this. I know what this is. I know what this is about. I've got to get this. And the thing was, when I went in to see him, he was really, really lovely. You know, I remember when you worked for us 3 years ago, and, you know, how are you, and what did you think of the script? And everything was really positive from David Croft all through it. It was one of those wonderful interviews. It's like a dream, you know, because I don't normally like that. Because I'm very tall, for instance, which is a bit of a disadvantage for an actor. I'm 6'4", you know, and it's often the reason they don't give you the job. And I could remember him saying, and how tall are you, Arthur? And I went, 6'4", excellent. And marvelous, you know, and I, this is incredible, you know. But I just kind of got the idea, you know. I knew what he wanted, and we talked about it. And then, of course, no mobile phones then, or nothing like that. So, but when I got home, which was about 6 o'clock in the evening on Friday, there was a message on the answer board saying I got the job. So. I knew nothing about it at 12 o'clock on that Friday. And by 6 o'clock, I got the job that changed my life. So, you know, long story, but that's how it happened. And various other people, you know, when we did a Low, a Low, I used to see people come in and do a small part. And David Croft was always watching them to see how they were. If they were interested in laughing along at the rest of the show that we were in rehearsal for, then he was grinning along with them. But if they went back, did their bit, however good they were, if they went back and then sat and read the paper and took no further interest, they never worked for him again. I mean, we never saw them again, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's obvious, really, when you think about it. Why wouldn't you? You'd want people who are enthusiastic and excited to be in it. And, so there we are. Long answer to that first question, but that's how it happened. It was quite an incredible story, really. What was it like working with the other cast on A Low, A Low? Well, when I joined it, which was about halfway through series two, I mean, the success of A Low, A Low happened very quickly. The first series, it was already really popular, which is unusual. It usually takes a couple of series to really get going. So I already knew who these people were. They were already kind of becoming famous. So it was a bit nerve-wracking for me. And they knew about this part that was coming in as well. They'd read the script in advance, so they knew who this was. And I think everybody could see the potential of Crabtree. But we didn't know until, you know, the studio audience laughed at it and that was recorded, which took some time. I did all the exterior filming before all that. And people were laughing at and saying that. I mean, everybody was really friendly and encouraging and welcoming and all that. But nevertheless, I was really quite nervous at first. I'd not done a filming job that long before. And I was also very well aware of how big a part this potentially could be. I always knew its potential. I could tell. That's what I could tell at the interview. I thought, this is it. And I was right, actually, because it was a great part. So, but everybody was very welcoming. And then, you know, slowly, I think really, in 1986, that's when we started the Hello Hello stage show. And I was asked to be part of that because already my part took off straight away. So they said, well, I think people would be surprised if you weren't in it. So I'd done two series with the company by then. And so we, you know, then I was just like one of the company, like everyone else. So it's kind of like when Sue Hodge joined later on as well. Then, you know, Francesca Gonshaw had been Maria in it, then she left, and then we had Sue. And, you know, that was either the next series, that series three or four. I can't remember when Sue came in, but, you know, then she was part of the company and we all joined in. So you've really got to work as a team, otherwise it doesn't work. And I think one of the reasons why Hello Hello was good, because it was a great team show. You know, everybody worked. So nobody was any more important than anyone else in that respect. You know, everybody watching it had their own favorites, so it all joined together, apart from, of course, an amazing script to go on with. Yeah. We did both. We filmed, well, the early series anyway, and the later series. I'll explain the difference. What we would do, there would be about how long would it be? About a month's filming on location in Norfolk, North Norfolk, in the Thetford Forest, which had all sorts of locations that we used all the time. There was Linford Hall, which is now a country house hotel, but then was privately owned, being used as a bit of a hotel, but it was in a bit of a ramshackle state. But the BBC used to go up, and it had a kind of big courtyard area in the middle that was covered with fake cobbles, and a pissoir was put up in it, and all sorts of other things like a fountain and or whatever like that weren't really there, but they were props. And that was the village square of Nouvion. And then there was one corner of that courtyard that became the exterior of Café René. So Café René, the sign would be put up there and all of that. So we would often be filmed, for instance, having a conversation in the village square, and then we're moving towards the cafe. So say, you know, yeah, so we're getting as far as the door of the cafe, and then it might be 6 or 7 weeks before we carried on that scene in the studios at Television Centre, where we'd be walking through the door and carrying on. So that's why you had to make sure, that's why continuity people had to make sure that, you know, if your hair looked exactly the same, the costume was exactly as it had been on there. So it's not done with Polaroid cameras now, but it used to be done with Polaroid cameras, where you'd have constant people taking photos of you on set, just to check how you look, you know, because I had a mustache, you know, what was the state of my mustache and my hair, and everything had to be kept the same. And that was the same for all of the cast. So, and what would happen then, you know, so you do all the exterior scenes for a whole series. So I could arrive, say, on my first day of filming, and I was doing something in episode 4. Because it was in this particular location. And then the next day I could be doing something in episode 1. So you had to, it was all out of order. But when we went into the studios, say a 6 or 7 or 8 episode series, so we would be 8 weeks doing that. So we'd record in the studio once a week. And Monday to Thursday, we were rehearsing in a rehearsal studio, which had setups of like the interiors, a version of Café René, where the tables are and all that. And it's just getting used to it. We didn't used to rehearse very long either, because I think everybody, you know, knew their characters. Often we were only really rehearsing about 20, 25 minutes worth of content. So there really wasn't, it doesn't take you long to do that, but we had to keep it going every day. And then on Fridays, this is in the early series, that's the day we were in the studio. So we'd be there all day doing on the sets. And then we'd do a dress rehearsal, and then there would be a break. And then the studio audience would come in. Because a lot of people still don't know that the laughter on all of those series is real. It's about 350 people that are in. And you can always tell real laughter from fake laughter, because actors wait for the laughs to die down before they do the next line, because otherwise, you know, you miss what they said. And if you hear people talking on and laughter kind of going over the top, you know it's not real. it's very interesting. So we always did it in front of a studio audience, and that's really, and again, I think it's something that's gone out of fashion now, but I think it gives an energy to everything, you know. I mean, we never used to think about the millions of people that were watching us at home, because you just can't imagine that anyway. But you can see and hear 350 people laughing and all that. So what would happen then is all of the scenes that we'd done on location filming, say if it was a scene where we'd done something in the village square of Nouville, and then we were going into Café René, everybody would be waiting on the set, waiting in the doorway of Café René outside in semi-darkness. And then the scene before would be played on monitor TV screens for the audience so that they could see the scene. And then at the end of the scene, the studio lights would go up, and we'd get the signal. And as quickly as possible, we would then start the continuing scene so that the audience got the whole feel of how the whole scene went. And you just go straight into it. And that's how a series was made. We used to not do many retakes, because people often say, oh, well, there must be some hilarious mess ups. And I suppose there are somewhere, but there weren't that many mistakes made. And sometimes it wasn't the actors that made it. It might be, you know, microphone boom come in, or the lights are off, or something didn't happen with switching cameras or something. Often it's nothing to do with the actors, but if an actor forgot a line or something, you'd have to stop. But my character had such a shock value often to what he said, you know, so I was really under pressure to get my scene recorded in one go, in one take. I mean, occasionally we had to go back and do things again, but you'd never really get the same laugh the second time, because they've already heard it. So sometimes I would think, oh, I could do that a bit better, or I wish I'd have another go at it. But I was never allowed to, because if David Croft, he was brilliant. I mean, he's like the captain on the bridge, you know. And if he knew he'd got what it needed, that was that, you know, you went on. So you just trusted him and you carried on. Was it hard mispronouncing the words with Crabtree? Well, no, actually, this is going to sound big-headed to me, but it's not. It's just, for me, it wasn't. That, you know, when I was talking about how I got, when I got the job at the interview, and I can remember reading that script, and I thought, oh, I know exactly what this is about. This is a send-up of English people that are going abroad with terrible French that don't use accents and whatever like that. I mean, and that this is what we sound to the French when we go over there. You know, it's a send-up of that. And I thought, that's why I thought it was genius, and I just got that straight off. So, but I think I've just got the kind of brain that can do that sort of thing. I mean, funnily enough, immediately after doing that first series that I did, I mean, literally the day after it finished filming, I was already booked to do a month's filming in Spain of a series called Return to Treasure Island. And I was playing a Spanish aristocrat called Don Felipe, who spoke with a French, with a Spanish accent and a very pronounced lisp. So I was thought of speaking like this, you know, I was doing the, and I went straight from doing Crabtree with all that kind of stuff to that. So it kind of, I haven't done much of that since, but I've always been able to imitate people. Not like the great, imitators like Rory Bremner or whatever like that, but I can do it pretty well. I've got a good ear and I could tell that sort of thing. So I think for me, it wasn't difficult, but it's the same as, everybody, really, this is a compliment on David Croft's casting, because I would say with all his series, you couldn't, like in Dad's Army, could you imagine anybody else playing Captain Mannering? Could you imagine anybody else playing Private Wilson? Could you in Heidi High see anybody other than Ruth Madoc playing, that, or Sue Pollard or whatever? No, they're perfect. And they're certainly the same with the Low Low. You can't imagine anybody other than Gordon Kaye. You can't imagine anybody other than Carmen Silvera playing Edith. All of the characters were so well cast. Everybody was brilliant at what they did, which made it kind of even more exciting and nerve-wracking when I first joined it, because I'd already was sort of fans of them, and here I was being with them, and about to take my own part in it. But everybody was so good at what they did and how they did it and their sense of timing and all of that kind of thing. So you just joining, it's like a jigsaw puzzle and the whole thing comes together. But no, I have, and to the extent that, as I said, with Crabtree, I can make it up as I go along now, which is a kind of peculiar gift to have, but there we are. I can do that now. It is no problem whatsoever. I've got lots of lovely memories of they're all really of people, most of whom have gone now, because one of the things about Alo Alo was there were a lot of us, there were a few of us that were kind of relatively young. I was 30 when I joined the cast, so I was one of the younger ones. Francesca Gonshaw was younger than that, but most of us, Richard Gibson, who played Herr Flick, and Kim Hartman, who's Helga, and Kirsten Cook as Michelle of the Resistance, Vicky Michelle. We were similar ages, sort of 30 or early 30s. And then there were a lot that were much older in their 60s and 70s. People like Jack Haig as Monsieur Leclerc and Richard Marner as the Colonel von Strohm and all of those. So, but one that really stands out that wasn't in every episode was Kenneth Connor, who played Monsieur Alphonse. Now, of course, he was famous to people for the Carry On films for years, but he was, everybody respected him so much because he was a wonderful, wonderful actor and the loveliest man, really. So he was someone, whenever he was in an episode, you just look forward to it. And I was lucky enough to have two or three scenes where I was with him. And he was such a joy to be with. And he was so funny without really doing anything, which is something I admire, deadpan sort of thing. Or so he, just a look or a raised eyebrow. And he was also much shorter than me. So we looked ridiculous on camera together. And I can remember coming, addressing him with one of, I don't know what it was I said, but one of Crabtree's lines. And he did a sort of double take and, kind of reaction thing. And we were recording and I just wanted to laugh, but you can't. You've got to keep it together, But he made me laugh. But he was the most lovely, kind friend, no, famous actor, much loved, but not even slightly big-headed or whatever, quite the opposite, very generous of spirit. And the real, there are a lot of actors, most actors are like that, they're quite shy off. I'm a sort of introvert, really. And a lot of people are, it's just that on stage or on television, we can sort of let down our inhibitions a bit. And I guess he was one of that. But I very happy members of that. I think really also filming particularly was very memorable, because we were away from home. There was a very jolly atmosphere. You know, we would go out to dinner in the evening and all of that. And it was great fun. And also the other times that were exciting, and not everybody was involved in this, but the stage show, when that was established, I mean, it first of all, it did a national tour, and then ultimately 5 seasons in the West End. But we did a tour of New Zealand back in 1988, and then also 2 times we went out to Australia, once with a big tour of the eastern states, and then we went back to do Perth. Well, anyone will say, I mean, that's filmed or taken anything abroad, to travel to the other side of the world, you know, somewhere as exciting as New Zealand or Australia, to be working and being paid, it's a really wonderful experience. And, you know, that world-class beaches, you know. And so in the daytime, you know, we could toddle off and spend an afternoon on the beach or traveling around exploring, and then maybe have a bit of a nap and then go in and do the show. And just doing it to people in Australia or New Zealand just brought it home to us just how popular the show was. I mean, as I think I said earlier, is that you never think of the millions watching it or where it's shown, but it was sold at its peak to over 80 countries worldwide, which just doesn't seem, I can't get my head around that. But it's very strange when we go on stage and everybody, when they made their first entrance, would get a round of applause when they're coming on. So when I finally went on, you know, good morning, big round, and you know, in Sydney or in Melbourne, and it was still happening. But I just incredible, really. So of course, those are the things that you never forget, you know, that kind of excitement. It's a long time ago now, but I'll never forget it. A favorite episode, I think, was a favorite scene. And this was there was a long series we did, which is series 5, because we were supposed to, just background to this, we were supposed to be being bought by America for 3 long series, which never happened to any series, BBC series before. And of course, American series are much longer than British ones, so 26 episodes. And we were going to do 26 episodes a year for 3 years. And so they built, instead of going to Norfolk to film, they built a studio, an indoor studio, for us at Elstree Studios, next to the EastEnders lot. So it was the EastEnders, and there was a Low filming there at the same time. We were out there for eight months doing all that. Well, those were slightly shorter episodes because they were being made initially for America, which has more commercial. It has commercial breaks. And so they were usually about 23 or 24 minutes long. But there was something about the shorter length of them that just, they were packed full of great stuff. I just think the writers were really on a roll in that series. There was some wonderful stuff. And I, by that time, I think it was that series where it first appeared, I had my own set. So they had a police station, which occasionally, you know, was on. So you'd see the exterior of the police station, and then inside there was a counter with all the kind of, and a lot of lost property behind it. So there were all sorts of things, like a big tuba and a trombone and a tank of fish and really weird things that people had left or lost or something, and they were buying them. So lots of brilliant stuff. Well, there was this particular episode where something had happened, I can't remember what, but René had to hide somewhere. So he rushes into the police station and asks to be locked up in one of my cells. And instead of, you know, this was the thing about Crabtree. He forgot by this time that he was supposed to be helping, that he was a British agent supposed to be helping the resistance, and sort of just thought he was a policeman, you know, a real policeman. So we had this extraordinary scene where you know, he said, I want you, Officer Crabtree, I want you to lock me in one of your cells. And I said, have you committed a crime, meaning a crime, you know? And he said, no, no. And I asked him for a sort of, I thought, well, I'd better ask him to see if there were any crimes that he'd committed. So I brought out a book and a pencil and a list of crimes. And I kept asking him, murder, no, biglary. Biglary with menaces and roup, handbag snatching, and all that. And he kept, it was just, and we were kind of like face to face, so really, both our faces close together over this countertop. And there was just something about the scene, it was utterly ridiculous, as most. Well, hello, things were, but certainly Crabtree stuff were. But I thought, gosh, this is a good piece of writing. And each line got a huge laugh. So it was really, really good. Because, with Gordon Kay as running, you never, not with everybody else, you never had to worry that they didn't know how to make the scene work. We all knew what we were doing and what the timing was and all of that. So I just loved it. I absolutely loved doing that. That was certainly my favourite scene. But there were a lot of episodes that I look at and I think, gosh, that's funny, But I it's so long ago now. If I watch a repeat, if not, if it just happens to come on and I think, oh, I wonder what episode this is, I'll often see myself appear like through the cafe door and I have no idea what I'm about to say or what the scene is about, because I did something like 75 episodes, and I got I can't remember at all. So I think fans remember them better than we do. Those of us that are left, and really that's the point about what I was saying about we were the younger ones, we're now the ones left, because sadly all the older actors that were in it have long gone. So there's an element of sadness about that fact, the fact that we're still being shown, but a lot of the people that made that the series aren't with us anymore. But those of us that are here, and we do get together for events every now and then, and one or two are personal friends of mine carrying on anyway, we're very proud of it. And sort of amazed, really, that whole other generations of people since we made it are watching it. I mean, I will do, say, I'll be doing a show or panto or something like that, and someone will come up to me after the show with a kid, an 8-year-old or something, and I assume that it's the mother or the father that's the fan of the series, and my son, really wants to meet you. He's a big fan, and you think, well, good heavens, I mean, this was made like 25 years before he was born, it's really weird. But I think that happens with Dad's Army, because it's like, if something is funny, it's funny, isn't it? It's still going to work. And I think the fact that, particularly with Dad's Army and Hello, Hello, both set in the war, anything wartime is in, it's in its own kind of time capsule. So it doesn't feel old-fashioned, in other words, like if something that was made in the 90s or the 80s might seem old-fashioned now. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's kept going. And I think immediately after it finished, it was, people had got a bit bored of it. And I think we made a couple of series too many, really. There's no point in not doing them, but we were asked to do them. But I didn't think much of the last two series we did. I didn't think they were up to the standard of the earlier ones. But that's my personal opinion. I know other people think the same thing. So it was a bit kind of old hat for a while. And it takes a while before nostalgia for a series comes in. I mean, look at what happens with something like Doctor Who, you know, the affection that people have for that, the fact that it came back, you know, and all of that. So having been left for a long time thinking that, oh, that's old hat, you know. I mean, I was 8 years old when Doctor Who started, and, you know, I'm 65 now. It's extraordinary how long that's gone, you know. So I think after a while, it also takes time for something to be termed a classic. And it certainly isn't for us that was in it to term it that. But people are now calling Hello, Hello a classic in the same way as they did with Dad's Army and other ones of its ilk. But it only time can do that. And people looking back and say, well, that really was that good. And I think that's true. I think it was. I think it was one of the, for all the things we've talked about, you know, the wonderful scripts, a director and producer in David Croft that was the best you could have, and really just a great cast. I mean, to put all those together, you're going to get something magical, and that's what happened. So we're very proud of it. It's been a difficult thing for me to shrug off, to be honest, because I'm known really for that. So, but I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Yeah, I'll give a little bit of a history behind the book. The book is called Good Morning France, Officer Crabtree's French Frosebook, which translated means Good Morning France, Officer Crabtree's French phrase book. And this came from an idea I had a few years ago. A few of us in the cast do things like fan conventions every now and then. So, you know, we've done them in Britain, but also abroad in Holland, Belgium, and other places where Hello, Hello is a big hit, you know. And really, at fan conventions, what you're meeting the fans and signing photos and things like that. We used to do, a few of these used to do pretty well every year, a big event down in Kent called the War and Peace Show, which is reenactment stuff, you know. I mean, enormous, acres and acres and acres of this site down a place called the Hop Farm in Kent, where so reenactment people will come. So there'll be a whole platoon of people, you know, in when tanks, people would dig trenches and sit in them all week, whatever the weather, or eating out billy cans or whatever like that. And huge tents with big marquees with wartime entertainment going on. And we used to get invited there because we were a wartime series and we were a sort of sideshow. And people would come and have their photo taken with us. And, you know, I mean, we were getting money for it, but it was always great fun and we were always so welcome. And I was looking one year for something different to sign. And I thought of this idea of doing a phrase book. So I made one it was more like a pamphlet. It was about 30 pages of how to do things. And I got it printed online and all that. And it looked quite good, you know. So anyway, they sold like hotcakes. And people kept coming back, this is hilarious. You should do the proper thing. You should do a real one, you know. And people coming back, oh, my mum wants one or my dad wants one, you know. And so it was amazing. I thought, oh, right, okay. Yeah, I was really pleased. And it was funny, you know, because everything was written down. And it was silly, like my character. So it took a long time before I got around to actually doing it. And I tried to get publishers' interest and everything like that. But it was difficult to put together because just a list of Crabtree phrases written in that way is not particularly, it's funny up to a point, but it's got to have a lot more elements in it than that. So, I mean, it's got terrific illustrations in the book, you know, by a friend of mine who sort of does a cartoon version of me with things it's saying, but it's brought it up to date as well, as if this is something you can take on holiday, you know, for your holidays and use going to the restaurant or to a cafe or to the beach. And pretty well everything in it, the Crabtree type. So it went on to really silly things like lists of books that you could get in, you know, the library or in a bookshop. So, you know, I had a wonderful time making Crabtree versions of famous books like Wuthering Heights for Wuthering Heights and Charles Dickens things like Bloke Hoose for Bleak House or something. I mean, it is utterly silly, but it's, I think, yeah, I mean, this is not doing it down or talking about, but I think it is your classic on the shelf in the bathroom book. Because a lot of people have comedy books in the loo or whatever like that. So, and where you'll have a couple of pages and, you know, and have a bit of a laugh and then put it back. It's not a book like a novel that you would read all the way through. It's definitely something to have a pick up, have a chuckle, or tell somebody else, or think of the, you know, and then put it down again. Well, that's certainly what people say that have read it and the feed book. there's a Crabtree feedback that comes back is like that, and so I'm proud of what we managed to do with it, because it's got a lot of variety in it. It's even got fake, I mean, sorry, but they are fake. It's as if people have asked questions. There's a whole thing called Ask Crabtree, and it's from people all over the country asking a question, and I just give the silliest of replies, you know. So, you know, somebody asks in Welsh, and of course he's no idea what that means, so just sort of fobs it off. It's a bit like Prime Minister's Question Times, but anyway, I had a lot of fun doing it, and as I said, very proud of it that actually got it done and published and out there. So, that's that. It did take me quite a while to write the book. I wrote a sort of bigger version of the small book that I'd done at the War and Peace show, first of all. And it sort of didn't really work because it was just lists of funny words and stuff like that. And there's a limit to what that's going to achieve. And then one publisher said they thought it would work if I did a half of it was the dictionary or the phrase book, and the other half were my memories of working on the series. And to me, that didn't make sense, because then that's two different books. I mean, if I wanted to do a memories of the series, I mean, Sue Hodge has done a book about her memories of the series. So, you know, that's already been done. Her memories are going to be different from mine in some ways, but a lot of are going to you know, lock. So I didn't see the point of that. My whole point was that I'd written it as Crabtree. So you've got British, because people forgot sometimes that he was a British agent. So, you know, and he used to be frightened like that, you know, like rather like the airman, you know. So I had to write the introductory bits of the book as Crabtree speaking in English, but not as I would speak, but as he would. So that's all in character. And then do the silly words later. So it took a while, and the publisher that I went with, he was really good and pushed me to, he said, this needs a lot of variety and different elements to it. And that's what took the time to decide what to do. So I think there's a lot more interest in the book than just a load of words and everything. I mean, for instance, I created imaginary pages of my policeman's notebook, policeman's notebook from, you know, from Nouvion Police Station, and my notes. And there's just silly things on that, you know, so that they're reproduced as if that's what I was doing. But they would refer, some of the notes would refer to things that happened in the series, and certainly to characters. And also, because we never really knew anything about Crabtree beyond the fact that he was a British intelligence officer sent over, we know nothing about his background or who he was, or, you know, I always thought he was probably been to a minor public school where he didn't do terribly well. You know, I mean, he's not very bright, Crabtree. And, you know, so there was a bit of kind of background information, therefore, in the book that I was allowed to do, because I had to obviously to get the permission of the of David Croft and Jeremy Lloyd's families in order to be able to do this, and they did give me that permission. And Penny Croft, David Croft's daughter, very encouraging in that. So she, and she liked the book very much. So, and gave me, but I was allowed therefore to take the character and run with it more. So for fans of the character, you know, it kind of fills it all out a bit more about what he was doing or what he thought, you know, beyond what the script had, you know. So it's kind of more. And I think if you think about a lot of series, I mentioned Doctor Who or whatever, there's loads of background books and things about everything to do with that, you know, that people will go into detail about what, you know, not quite what the Daleks are doing at home, but, you know, the kind of background stuff. And I think that always interests people that loved the series in terms of this, because people like yourself are asking questions about how it was when we did it. But I think the book will definitely, I mean, it doesn't talk about the television series because it's pretending to be real, but I think it takes people on a bit of a journey anyway. And it also brings it up to date, which makes no sense at all, because he'd be about 120 years old now. But you just have to accept that. I mean, you just have to accept. The whole thing, I don't know whether you remember, but Alo-Alo had a kind of brief reprise in 2007, where a documentary was made about Alo-Alo, and also we did some new scenes, which is something I never thought we'd ever do. And Jeremy Lloyd wrote that. And I mean, there were lots of people, like celebrity fans of Alo-Alo, that I didn't even know. They were interviewed about that, and I was interviewed. Various members of the cast that were still alive were interviewed about the making of it. So it made a kind of 2-hour program. But we did 6 scenes in Cafe Rene. So I actually put the uniform on and did it again. And, you know, so did Sue Hodge and Kirsten Cook and Richard Gibson as Herr Flick and Sue, you know, a few of us did it. And the plot idea that Jeremy Lloyd had for the because this was up to date, or certainly later on anyway. And Crabtree came in as still as a policeman. So after the war, he'd never bothered to go home. You know, he's just like, quite liked life in Nouvion. There was nothing really for him back in England. So he stayed there, became a policeman, and still became the real policeman for the village of Nouvion, which I thought was just a brilliant, simple idea, which had never been introduced in the series at all. You know, so it just made perfect sense that he'd never bothered to go home. Whereas, you know, Herr Flick was, I think, a bank manager. You know, he came in a suit, you know, not the way that you expect. And other people, what they had become. I think Yvette had still stayed there, and then she was sort of now running the cafe or whatever with all of that. But there was a sort of new story about what had happened to people. But I just, so I took that idea that he'd never gone home as part of the reason why he eventually, you know, later on when people started to go on holidays to France, had the great idea of writing a phrase book. Oh, well, I know all about, well, that's why I'll write a phrase book. Never the fact that he never really got to learn French properly. And of course, the silly thing is I do speak French. Actually, I don't speak it fluently anymore because I don't use it. But I even won a prize at school for spoken French, and I did French A level, and I did it as a subsidiary subject at university. So my teachers at school, you know, when I started to appear in Alo-Alo, got a lot of flack about that I was now sending up French. But that's really the background to how the book came about. And, there's a foreword to the book by Rick Wakeman, who, for those of you who don't know, is an incredibly famous musician, was leading member of the band Yes in the 60s and 70s, but then was a superstar when I was young, late teens, early 20s, doing solo albums and all of that. Well, what happened with Rick was every now and then we as members of Hello Hello, you get invited to charity dinners and things like that, you know, and various people from comedy shows or singers or whatever like that will be invited to that, and people are, you know, they get your autograph or whatever, things like that, and they can be really fun events. And there was one I was at, and I was talking with someone, and I suddenly noticed Rick Wakeman the other side of the room. I went, oh my god, you know. Because, you know, even though I've been on television and all that stuff, there are people that I come across, I think, wow, you know, it's like, because they're so, you know, huge personas. So anyway, the next thing that happened, I don't know whether he noted me looking at him or whatever, but he suddenly came over, and I think I was talking to Guy Siner, who was a Gruber, but it was certainly another member of the Hello Hello cast. And he came over and he said, It is you two from Hello Hello, isn't it? And we'll go, yeah. And he said, oh, I'm such a big fan. Oh, God, I loved your series. And we're all going, we're thinking, Rick Wakeman is who we are, and he loves what we do. You know, I mean, and anyway, he's such a lovely man, you know, and he's just brilliant. And I've seen him several times since. And every time, you know, he was always really jolly. And we said, you know, we said, well, it's the highlight of our evening that we've met you. And he said, well, it's the highlight of my evening that I've met you, you know. So it was brilliant. So when it came to asking someone, you know, whether they would do the foreword for the thing, I thought, well, it's got to be someone that people have heard of, but also someone who genuinely likes it. And I just thought of Rick, and I hadn't seen him for years. But I managed to get in touch, you know, via his agent and send an email. And this is what's so brilliant. I sent him an email, and he knew who I was, obviously, like that, but and he's a very busy man. But I asked him if he would write the foreword of this thing. And what I got was a one-sentence reply. I would be deluded, which is a Crabtree word, you know. So he did do it, and he wrote a lovely, I was really chuffed at what he wrote and how much, obviously, the series had meant to him. So that's how that came about, which was just another thing that just adds to the book to me, that makes, you know, I think it's, I was very proud of the fact that he said yes to it. Well, you could, it's not really being stocked in bookshops all over the country, unfortunately, but it is available on Amazon. So it has its own page, like all books, and that you can order it off that. Or if you go to, if the other idea is you can buy it directly from the publishers, which is Waterside Press, and their website is watersidepress.co.uk, and from there you can just order it and they will send it out to you for that. That's probably the best way, I think, to do it. If you go to Waterside Press, that'll just, because some things with Amazon at the moment, I think, you know, it's only really essential things that are going out. So other businesses, I think, are quite pleased if you go direct to them, but you can get that. But, you know, I'm speaking to you at the moment in Lockdown, as Crabtree would call it, lockdown. So you can't go to a bookshop, but you could always order it from a bookshop, and they would be able to get hold of it. You know, that's not a problem. Even if they're not stocking it itself, you can always do that, you know, later on.